In 2018 and 2019, St. John's Lutheran Church in Northville, Minnesota is conducting oral histories of its members. My name is Eric Sponheim, and today I will be interviewing St. John's member Joseph Shaw, longtime member of the congregation. Welcome, Joe, and I'm looking forward to hearing your St. John's story.
Thank you.
When did you first join St. John's, and what attracted you to the church?
I joined in the fall of 1957, and I guess I didn't need anything to attract me to the church. I was somewhat acquainted with the congregation and the church from my student days, so there was no period of weighing which church to go to. My wife and I just kind of automatically headed for St. John's as soon as we got to town.
You were a new faculty member in 57?
Yes.
And what year had you graduated from?
I graduated in 1949.
Tell us a little bit about your family's involvement in the congregation, the names of family members, who they are.
Right. My wife's name was Mary Virginia. She went by Ginny. Much of the time. And our daughters are Nancy, Betsy, Margaret, and Mary. And the girls, of course, got into Sunday school, and in due time got into the appropriate choirs for their ages. And in due time, not right away, but after a while, then I joined the senior choir. And If you're asking about the role of St. John's in my life and our family's life, there's quite a few things to mention. I think number one is the worship, just being here for Sunday worship. And as I said, I eventually got into the choir toward the end of the time when Fred Schmidt was the director of senior choir. And then when Carolyn Jennings became the director, I continued on for some over 20 years, I believe. Two of our daughters were married here, their weddings were here. All of the girls were baptized here, and I was proud to have carried each one of them to the baptismal font. Ginny's funeral was here, and that felt right. So, kind of across the board, and I'll be mentioning some other things later in committee involvements and the like.
You're very good at anticipating the next question, Joe. You've already talked about some of the highlights of your experience as a church member, including carrying those children at baptism, right? You're very, as a man, as men, we're not as accustomed to doing that probably. So that's, try to be very careful.
In part, I guess I kind of pressed to do that just because it was not common.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was objecting to it, so it was fine. Well, early on, I served as a member of the Board of Deacons, and that would have been either the late 50s, having joined in 57, or into the very early 60s. I remember Boral Bjorn was our pastor, and he conducted the deacons meetings. Then we had deacons and trustees. Later we got a combined church council. And I will say that one of the things that came out of that period of service on the Board of Deacons, and one hesitates to sound as if you're taking credit for something, but historically, it is the case that that board began the discussions of the series of steps that eventually led to the Northfield Retirement Center. And we as a board discussed that, and out of our discussions, a member by the name of Joe Wang picked up the ball, and I cannot explain, I don't have the information. But I know that he was sort of the leading figure then for the next period, as St. John's then joined with other churches, and in due time, the retirement center began out in the northwest part of the town. So I thought that was a significant thing to be part of. Mm-hmm. I served as president of the congregation somewhere around 1966. And an interesting sidelight of that was, again, not to toot one's horn, but at that time, they were still electing the congregational president from two candidates. So there was a real election. It wasn't just moving up from vice president to president. So the other candidate for the job was Don McRae. And the vote was taken, and I was the one who got the, I was elected. And that period as president of the congregation, I think Judy has done that too. I don't think it was particularly distinguished. We took care of routine business. I do remember a phase of it that was a bit embarrassing on the part of the church council, which as president at that time, I think we had moved away from deacons and trustees to church council. Well, we as a church council had voted to a big sum of money for some project or other. I've forgotten what it was. We came before the annual meeting and said that the board had announced that we're going to spend $30,000 or something like that. And we were kind of caught in an embarrassing position, because in the congregation was a sharp person by the name of Sid Rand. And he immediately wanted to know, what are your plans for paying back this loan? Well, gulp, blush, we hadn't built that into what we had to say, you know, and we didn't look good in front of the congregational meeting that time.
Well, you've really called attention to some governance aspects of the congregation that are important in bringing us to where we are now. It wasn't a church council originally. There was more bicameral, even with
yes.
trustees and
which
deacons.
Was the old yeah. way of doing things: board of deacons, board of trustees. Yes, in the old days, people would say kind of half cynically, "Well, the deacons have to do with spiritual things, and the trustees with material things."
Well, you are a well-documented historian. This next question is totally in your wheelhouse. How has the church changed over the time of your membership? We could probably spend the next the remaining time on that, but we do want to touch on the future of the church too.
Could we delay that question?
Oh, absolutely.
I have in my notes here something more that belongs in the question above, which was about service and leadership.
Yes.
I wanted to state that I, years later, in this century, in about 2005 or thereabouts, I was placed on the board of evangelism and communication. I served on that board 1 year, and the next year I was chair, asked to be chair.
Wonderful. That's us, Joe. That's our committee that's
okay.
doing these.
Yeah. Well, couple of things. When I became chair, I wanted us to do some evangelism. And I know the times have changed, and the word evangelism has all kinds of baggage that you have to sort through. But I sort of sold the board on the idea of trying to do what I thought of as kind of low-keyed evangelism, and that was to make connections with the neighbors, house to house, right in this loop, right on all sides, especially the three sides of St. John's, because there's a school over there. Mm-hmm. So we went door to door, and we had some little piece of paper with a welcome neighbor, was kind of the theme that we pushed. And we had ambitions to get acquainted with these immediate neighbors, and if they had children, get the names of the children and you know, encourage them to attend and so on. It was not blazingly successful. I do recall a lady from across the street who was a Roman Catholic who responded to our manor and did come over for the Christmas dinner. But by and large, it didn't really amount to a great deal. I thought in theory the idea was good, but I think we're living in an era when people are a little bit edgy about someone at their door. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm happy to mention a couple of successful things that we did as a board. One was we started a visitation program. We figured that John Quam had his hands full. So we, as members of the board, we rounded up about a total of 12 people. We called ourselves the St. John's Visitors or the Friendly Visitors or whatever. And we would meet here in the church. And pretty soon those meetings weren't necessary because it's kind of obvious what we were about. And that was just to visit people who were not able to come to church, the so-called shut-ins. And that included folks out at the retirement center. So I remember Phil and Barbara Eves were part of it. Georgia Browlick and Jean Schaefer and some others, Doug Finn and Lydia Quanbig. So we each had persons assigned to us, or we assigned them ourselves, and proceeded. And that program kept going while I was on the board. Then when I went off the board, it passed over to a couple of other people who just, for various reasons, did not continue it. So it kind of faded out. I kept up my practice of going out to the retirement center and seeing people on my own schedule, and that continues to the present. And I will dare to use the word, I'm proud of our initiating the Christmas dinners. And I was inspired, and I suppose the rest of us, by the example of the Moravian Church. They began giving an Easter dinner that was free to anybody in the community who wanted to come. So we sort of grabbed that model and applied it here for a Christmas dinner. And that enterprise is still going.
Indeed. So one thread we've identified in our conversation so far with others is how important Stephen's ministry is here. But you called attention to some other initiatives that some of which have really taken hold, like the Christmas dinner.
When we started our visitation program, we did check with the Stephen ministry just to make sure there's no unnecessary overlapping, and that you know, there was no problem there. I have been a beneficiary of the Stephen ministry when Ginny died, when Pam Schwant faithfully sent me they have booklets to grieving people, and every week for 4 weeks I'd get one of these in the mail. And I just the other day passed them on to a person who's lost her husband, so.
We talked some about governance, some about evangelism and other forms of outreach. What about the worship experience, Joe? Could you say a few words about that? And we can, if you like, we can segue into change over time, or if you have other initiatives that you've been involved in you want to mention, that's good too. But it has to start with worship, as you know.
Yeah.
And like to hear your thoughts on that. I know you're at Second Service very, very regularly.
Yeah. Well, On the whole, of course, anything I say, I want it to be positive, because I think that's the heart and center of the church's life to me. And a visible change in worship at St. John's, people today would not realize it, but we used to have communion services less than every Sunday, like once a month. And there was a bit of a debate. It was friendly enough, but the congregation needed to kind of push itself to get to communion every Sunday. And I remember on the not so fast side was a dear friend Ellen Hansen, who was a great churchman, but reflected a point of view that's not bad, but it's a different point of view, that if you have communion every Sunday, it will cease being real special. Mm-hmm. And I think he spoke for a lot of people for a generation and then some. On the other side, the aggressive side, that yes, the church does commune every Sunday. That's historic, and that goes way back. That was Vern Fiatah, which was interesting. And of course, the upshot of it was we did move to communion every Sunday.
That was early 80s, or when would you point to?
I can't nail that down. That would be close. Could possibly have been in the 70s, later 70s. No. And we've always had a worship and arts committee, and needless to say, music has played a big role in the worship life of the congregation. I've enjoyed being part of the worship in terms of being in the senior choir for a good many years. But the time came when I told Carolyn that from then on I was in my retirement years and I wanted to sit in the pew with my wife. So, and she obviously understood that.
How about adult forums? Did rehearsals for choir overlap with adult forums some, so that would so it was hard to be involved in both, or?
I was involved in both, and in fact, I had a note here somewhere that I was from time to time on some committee or other that was pushing the adult forums, and as an agitator in that regard, I was always pushing for having an adult forum program that would incorporate biblical and theological themes. And as a member of the religion department at the college, I had access to colleagues who would be willing to come down and give lectures, and of course we got many other people. So that was an ongoing thing. I don't recall that it conflicted much with choir rehearsals. On It's true that the choir would have the warm-up before the service, but if, for instance, even then I think we sang at the 8:30 at the early service more often than we sang at the second service.
And my understanding is that Eric Lund was very involved over the years in the adult forum.
Very much, yes, yeah, both as a committee member and a speaker himself. And I gave a lot of talks over the years at the adult forum, and many of them would of course spring out of the particular book I'd been writing or had written. And I gave talks on the St. Olaf Choir and on Baron Julius Moos, the founder of this congregation, and the first two presidents of the college, Torbjörn Mohn and John Nathan Kildow, were both pastors of St. John's. And I've given talks on the relationship between St. John's and St. Olaf. And I'm due to give a talk again that I gave some years ago to the choir when it visits here, the St. Olaf Choir, to tell the story of the relationship between the St. Olaf Choir and St. John's Church, in as much as the choir was born here at this church in 1912 and earlier.
We almost could do a separate interview on St. Olaf, St. John's connection.
Yes, right. Right.
We'll flag that as a possibility. But to let's talk some about change over time. Just very open-ended question to you there. We've touched on a number of things already that have changed over time, whether it's governance or helping to put in place some of these kind of really key infrastructures like the Christmas dinner that, I mean, as someone who's been around only a few years, I take it for granted, mm-hmm. but it came from somewhere. What comes to mind that we haven't touched on regarding change over time for the congregation?
Let's see if I can say this in a way that makes sense. I am not up on our actual membership numbers. How many we are. I don't know those. But I think the church is growing. We every once in a while we have new members Sunday, and of course people drop away and people die. I do have this comment that's a general one, and I don't have a way of explaining it or accounting for it, but it's a sheer matter of attendance, whatever the membership is, but the attendance does not seem as robust as it once was. A clear-cut example, and quite a vivid one, is that I associate this with a period when Loyal Golf and David Thompson were our pastors. We had, in the Lenten season on Wednesday nights, we had to have two services. That was regular for the Lenten season, in order to accommodate the number of people who came, which I thought was quite remarkable. When I go to the second service, now I'm quite willing to concede, maybe as of now, maybe the dynamic is the first service is better attended. I don't know that for a fact, but it kind of looks like it when you look at the parking lot. But the second service can often look kind of thinly attended when you look around you and see empty places. So that's, you know, that's just an overall kind of an impression. Changes, people dress differently, they're much more casual. I'm one of the old holdouts who comes with a tie and a jacket. That's kind of refreshing. The communion has gotten into a pattern. We used to kneel around the altar, you know, back then, and we no longer do that. But that's, everybody seems to take that in stride. I think St. John's basically is a progressive congregation, evidence being this huge building we built right next to St. John. To our church, St. John's Hall. That was kind of a risk and a gamble, and it was tight financially for a while, but we did it.
With your first point about just the sheer attendance numbers, it does call attention to a broad sociological phenomenon that's happening. What it does lead into the question too that we have towards the end about the future of the congregation and of the church. What are your hopes there? It does seem like for the millennial generation and after, the role of the church is a bit different. I'm a baby boomer. Greatest Generation. It's a different role for the church for today. What are your hopes there for what we can do here.
Well, you're a member of the Evangelism Board, so I'm kind of stumped as to how this generation does evangelism. And I think at the minimum, people in places of responsibility should at least be knocking their heads against this. Keep asking, what are the elements? I think the congregation is conscious of the need for outreach. That's maybe the word that's more palatable than evangelism. I think any congregation in our day needs to figure out ways to do the outreach. And I think the Wednesday night meals are a good example and a successful one. The Christmas dinner also sort of fits in that category. But a more subtle but more substantial thing is a worship service and preaching. Now, we are blessed with good preachers, and I'll just take as a given that they are good preachers, and kind of whatever else I'm going to say doesn't have to do with them particularly. Mm-hmm. But speaking as just a church member and trying to look at the larger scene, I think that at the heart of the church's ministry in the world has been having a message that is so compelling that it draws people. And you know, it's easy to say that, but it's not that easy to ask our pastors to do that. But I think that's at the heart of it. It's something that doesn't get discussed very often. That is that the preaching and the worship service as a whole, but we're Lutherans, and with Lutherans, a sermon is very important. It's got to be something deeper than the kind of popular stuff that the mega churches are able to draw crowds with a superficial sort of feel-good message. And you know, some of these successful television preachers who preach success, and that being in relationship with God means prosperity and success and all of that. So there's, I guess that's one thing that I keep thinking about, that hard as it is to execute, but a kind of worship experience that is not afraid to get right at the depths of the human condition, whether that is despair or sin or guilt or whatever it is, people hurting, a gospel that heals and that lifts up and that redeems. It's nothing new about that, but that's much on my mind.
That's powerful. Anything to add to what we've talked about already?
Well, having said what I just said now, behind and under such an effort or such an aim, of course, is the whole life of prayer. And I'm pleased to see in each Sunday service folder there's a name you can call for prayer requests, and the way our lay people serving as assisting ministers do write their own prayers, I think that's wonderful. I think that's a real plus. And that's part of the enrichment of the worship service.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Joe, that knowing that your PhD dissertation was on the people of God, that is, it is the laos, the people there, yeah, writing those prayers. I've had that gig a couple of times, and there is some homework on Saturday night, yeah, if you're on for, right, that. But it is very refreshing every week to have that some different voices, mm-hmm, that you hear. Yeah. You never quite know what you will hear,
right,
in those prayers.
And in those prayers, I'm always happy as a fellow member to hear prayers that are for the larger world scene, for the famines, for the wars, for the oppression, for the societal needs, whatever they are, and they are many, as we well know. That's good to. That's part of outreach too. The same mindset that's thinking beyond ourselves. And that too, I think is healthy for the congregation if in all of its work to kind of get beyond our own unit here. If I were an expert, you could study the budget and see how much do we spend on ourselves and how much do we spend for the needs out there. And I've always felt that a healthy congregation should aim at spending as much for out there outreach, the suffering world out there, as it does for our own needs here, the heating the buildings and paying the staff and all that.
Right. We're not about only chaplaincy and taking care of the building. It's about even, and you, I mean, to hear early on here in this talk about how you, as chair of the ENC board,
Communications.
How you oversaw that program to literally knock on doors, you know, to try to reach out.
Well, it was an experiment.
Well, last time, going on this question, anything to add? And I wouldn't be surprised if you do, but if you don't, that's fine, and we can wrap up shortly, Joe.
I think we can wrap up pretty soon. The things to add that I have touched upon, that I've given quite a number of talks and participated in the adult forum, in both in the planning and giving occasional talks myself.
And you've got one coming up, you said.
When the choir visits in January, I gave such a talk a few years ago when we were celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of the St. Olaf Choir, which was in 2012. Then the choir members, having sung at the first service and being ready to sing at the second service, in between, we met in St. John's Hall, and I gave them a talk about the birth of the choir here and the ongoing relationship between the choir and St. John's Church, and I'll be giving that same talk again. The problem is I can't find any notes that I had on that, so.
Well, it'll be fresh then.
I'm going to have to wing it.
It'll be fresh. Thank you, Joe, for sharing your story and your family's story as part of the St. John's Lutheran Church Sesquicentennial.
You're very welcome.